Now, I've probably mentioned it a few times in the previous lessons that I'm not a great big fan of parts count predictions. And there was a study by, a university professor out of England that I'll try to remember to put a link to in the notes for this lesson, that did the study where they actually made predictions using a variety of techniques to the best ability that they could in following the procedures, and compared that to actual field data. They had a set of circuit boards that had fairly decent or robust tallies of their performance in different operating environments. And so they were able to compare the results to what they expected to get from the prediction. Needless to say, it was dismal. Some were off by plus 600% or minus 100%. They were very far from reality in almost all cases. And so the conclusion was that if it did happen to be close to the actual performance, it was simply luck that that's what happened. But the basic idea of a parts count prediction is you tally up the failure rates. And as I explained in the last lesson, one of the features of using the exponential distribution is that that product of reliability terms at a point in time is the same as adding the failure rates, then doing the math for the exponent. And so it takes into account that ability to do a little bit of math. But where do those failure rates come from? I remember watching or listening to Pat O'Connor, who wrote the Practical Reliability Engineering book, and I think it's in its fifth edition at this point. But he worked as a repair technician for communication boxes back in his younger days for the military in Britain. And every day they had to list and tabulate what repairs they executed on the different boxes they were troubleshooting and repairing. And he said him and his colleagues rarely used any accurate information in tallying these, what was repaired. In some cases, they didn't really know. They replaced 10 or 12 components and it started working, when in reality, it could have been just a connector that they had to disconnect and reconnect to gain access to the circuit board. So he knew firsthand that the data that was being collected and then eventually being used to create these tabulated failure rates was highly suspicious right at the source. Now, the data may or may not be suspicious in the variety of things that are reported. And later, over the years, I've talked to people that have worked on the process of collecting this data. And they had two problems. One was just getting access to failure rate data, and two is verifying its validity in how it was collected and how accurate it was. But handbooks like Mill Handbook 217 is a collection of this data. You know, Mill Handbook 217 hasn't been updated in, I think, over a decade. And even then, the data that was within it was probably another decade old. So if you're using 20 to 30-year-old technology, pulling failure rate data from Mill Handbook 217 may be appropriate. But one of the tenets of these part count predictions is that they need to be representative sources of data to how your product is being, its application, with stresses both from the design and from the use in the environment, I should say, contribute to its failure rates. I know at Hewlett-Packard when I was there, they had at one time had pretty robust repair processes where they collected down to the component level what was required to repair a product and put it back in service. And they did an extensive amount of failure analysis to understand exactly what was contributing to the failures. So internally, they had their own failure rate data for a whole range of different components. Now, that was on their products with their designs and with their customers. So in those cases, it was relatively accurate and it was maintained regularly. But once that started to break down and the repair data was not collected as rigorously, those models quickly became, well, I wouldn't say less than useless, but they weren't counted on anymore for making decisions. Now, in the parts count prediction process, Mill Handbook 217, Telcordia, and many other models that are out there, it's not just adding up the failure rates and then sorting out the reliability. They also have these pi factors. In this case, it's Q1 or pi sub Q, which could be the quality factor of that component. But there might also be a number of different pi values that are multipliers to the failure rate. And they can be the first year of production, or they can be the type of technology, or they can be, I think there's like 4 or 5, maybe 10 different pi factors that you can apply to each one of these different failure rates. And getting all of that data, which is in oftentimes in very large buckets, can be, one, tedious, but two, difficult to obtain, even if you put your best effort to it. But the basic idea is I have a fundamental failure rate, and then I modify it to try to simulate my current situation. But if you're starting with a bad failure rate at the start from poorly collected or poorly reported data, I don't care what kind of modification you make to it, it's probably not going to be useful. Now, having said all that, if your product line is relatively stable and you're making small variations to your product, say on an annual basis, and you do predictions on a regular basis, you could eventually start comparing the predictions to your actual performance. And then if it's consistent, create an offset to do a correction to, say, your Mill Handbook 217 prediction to bring it closer to reality. But that only really works if you have a decent correlation between your predictions and your results. Now, with so much outsourcing, with changing vendors, supply chains, and in a constant amount of turmoil, it's becoming relatively rare that you have a consistent, stable process that goes through the design, supply chain, and production process. So use that at your own risk. Parts stress analysis adds just another level of complexity to this parts count model. Again, it starts with these, in my opinion, air quotes here, flawed failure rates, base failure rates. But then it modifies it by what's the temperature that this product is being used at, or what's the amount of voltage that's being used at? What are the different stress levels that are being applied to this component? And underlying that, there may be, and oftentimes it's just empirical, a relationship between the stress level and its eventual failure rate. And again, the models themselves and the analysis of the field data does a pretty decent job at coming up with these stress factors. It's just that if you start with a bad failure rate, it doesn't matter how you modify it, you still have a bad failure rate, in my opinion. But parts count is adding up failure rates and maybe some conditional or manufacturing-related modifiers. When you add temperature or voltage or other stress levels to the equation, then you're doing a parts stress analysis. And these can be more detailed and rigorous, and avoiding the use of these constant failure rate lambdas. But that's beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about. The basic concept, though, for parts count or part stress analysis is basically tabulate the failure rates. It's essentially the process that's used. Now, when I first ran into parts count prediction, I was asked to do this, and my boss said, you should know how to do these things. And about an hour into understanding the process and starting to collect the data, I went back to my boss and said, this really doesn't make much sense. Why would I want to do this? Why would anybody want this number? Because I can tell that it's just going to be a fictitious number. It might as well just give them a random number. And he said, well, there's a couple of things that are useful. One of them is that the the parts count prediction assumes that every part contributes to the failure of the overall system. Now, some components, if they fail, won't even be noticed in any significant way by the customer, so they don't really contribute to the overall failure, whereas other ones dominate what the failure rates are. So I was aware of that phenomena, but there's also this corollary that the more parts you have, the more chances for failure you have. And so doing a parts count prediction, in one regard, accounts for how many chances of failure is within the design. So if the designer knows that that's one of the measures being used, there's an emphasis on using fewer parts. The other part, the other element of the parts count or stress analysis, is temperature is often a big factor. So keeping electronics, especially cooler, helps them last longer. And again, the parts count stress analysis tends to take that into account. Thus, it encourages the right behavior from your design team. Fewer parts and keep them cooler. But it's also a decent tool to help you understand where the risks are. If you're using lots and lots of capacitors, individually they may not be an issue, but the sheer number of them may show up as being a dominant failure mechanism for path to failure, for chance of failure for your product. On the other hand, it's not as useful in predicting quality or warranty issues, although it can be early on when you have no other information available. I find the biggest use is to do comparative analysis, looking at different architectures or different approaches and seeing what the relative changes in reliability would be. But even that, I think, is pretty inaccurate. So in practice, they're not all that accurate. In practice, you're going to see it, you're going to have to interpret it, you're going to have to probably create some of these if you don't already. The idea, though, if you're seeing a requirement for parts count prediction and it's used for nothing more than a checkoff box on a procurement process, I wouldn't invest a whole lot of time into it. On the other hand, if it's in providing feedback to your design team, it might be worth finding out what they really need and work to provide that feedback rather than what is a little more, in my opinion, a random number. Next, we're going to look at some of these prediction methods and, you know, a little more detail about when and where we would use these.